CMC Markets is a pioneering CFD and spread betting provider. With more than 30 years of experience, CMC Markets provides traders with the tools they need to trade confidently. 76% of retail investor accounts lose money.
Welcome to the City View podcast in partnership with CMC Markets. I'm Andy Sylvester, acting editor of City AM, and we'll launch right into the news, analysis, and interviews that you need for the week ahead in the city. Hello and welcome to the City View podcast in partnership with CMC Markets. I'm Andy Sylvester, acting editor of City AM, and in a little while I'll be joined by Bill Browder, the investment banker turned campaigner who has become one of the very spikiest thorns in Vladimir Putin's side. We'll talk about Bill's career, from running Russia's largest foreign investment fund to being deported and then pursued across much of the world, as well as how we should judge the current protests in Russia, the future of Alexei Navalny, and the role of the West and the City of London in checking Vladimir Putin's global ambitions. I will also be talking to Amanda Latham, Barnett Waddingham's pensions lead, about the Go Green agenda and what master trusts and pension funds will need to do to meet their new legal obligations. But first, though, I'll turn to James Warrington, one of City AM's star reporters who you've heard from before. We're going to look at two stories from across the pond, but we're not going to look at the Reddit GameStop brouhaha because, frankly, I think we're still in the fog of war on that one. And by the time you listen to this from when we've recorded it, we might look very silly indeed. Instead, we're going to look first at Apple. James, another gravity-defying week for the firm.
Absolutely. We've talked before about what a great year it was for tech in 2020, but sometimes it takes a set of figures to hammer the point home. And that's what we had this week, really, with some eye-watering numbers from Apple, which earned fourth quarter revenue of $111.4 billion. Now, that puts it in an exclusive club of companies to earn more than $100 billion in a single quarter, alongside companies such as Walmart and ExxonMobil, although Amazon is expected to pass this milestone as well next month. And it was success across the board, really, for Apple. It benefited from pent-up demand for the iPhone 12, which came out in October, as well as higher sales of Macs, iPads, and wearables. And it was also a good quarter for its services division, which is the real growth area for Apple at the moment, and was the first full quarter for its new Apple One product, which bundles together TV, music, and cloud storage into one subscription. So analysts will probably be keeping a close eye on that, but really it's the story of how tech is not only weathering the pandemic storm, but really thriving under it.
Yeah, you wonder what could ever knock Apple off course at this point. Perhaps a rogue Tesla. And it was a big week for them as well. Elon Musk in suitably bullish mood for a change, talking very much about the hopes of the firm to keep growing, the fact that sales of self-driving cars were just around the corner. At what point do we start to say Tesla are definitely for real? And at what point do we say, well, hang on, their profits are regulatory credits led? They're still not necessarily converting hype into sales and profits. Where do we sit on Tesla? And just give us a quick steer on what, no pun intended, on what we saw from them last week.
Yeah, well, that's the big question, isn't it? I mean, it really was a stellar year for Tesla. Its share price soared 700% over the 12 months, and it was admitted to the S&P 500. With this week's quarterly earnings, there is cause for celebration. It was their first ever $10 billion quarter for revenue. And of course, Musk has done well out of it himself, overtaking Jeff Bezos to become the world's richest person. But as you say, there are some questions about profit margin there. So you mentioned the regulatory credits. These are given to electric vehicle companies. And Tesla is so far ahead of its rivals that it's able to sell these on. And that drives a lot of its profits. And analysts have questioned whether, as the competition begins to heat up, its reliance on these might become a problem. But I think it won't be worrying too much at the moment. Obviously, car sales have been affected by the pandemic. It may need to shift more to its more expensive vehicles, which have a higher profit margin. But for the time being, I think Musk and his company will be celebrating. And really, it should be another good year for Tesla.
Yeah, well, we shall see. James, thank you. Before you go, I promise we wouldn't get into Reddit GameStop, but if you could sum it up in one word, what would it be?
Chaos.
And chaos is good fun. Thanks, James. We'll speak again. We usually look now at the week to come, usually at markets and various other things, but we thought we'd have a look at an industry, a sector this week. And that's why we're joined by Amanda Latham, who's from the firm Barnett Waddingham. And we are going to talk about pensions. Not yours, mercifully. This isn't a personal finance podcast just yet, but instead about the wider scene, what we might expect in 2021. We've already seen quite a lot of action already. Amanda, pleasure to have you with us today.
Thanks very much.
Give us a quick pressy of developments in 2021 already, because we have already seen some action from DWP. Just last week, we saw the pensions minister and DWP put out all its information around climate disclosure and the need for pension funds to be a bit more open, a bit more transparent about their climate responsibilities. It's going to have a massive impact, both in terms of the amount of work involved, people doing it, but also hopefully in terms of getting Britain towards a slightly greener future. So just give us a quick kind of 60-second summary of what we've seen already.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So I think, so what you've just referred to that we've seen in the last week, so that's the government's consultation on the sort of embedding what's known as the Task Force for Climate-Related Financial Disclosures, or TCFD, recommendations for pension funds. So this was sort of the framework for this began to be set last year by the Pension Schemes Bill, giving the government powers to make regulation in this space. So now we're starting to see the detail being filled in around that, and starting to see the sort of proposals about what trustees are going to have to do. So they're going to need to understand and assess how their pension scheme that they're running is contributing to climate change, how exposed it is to climate risks, and also to make decisions based on climate considerations. So they'll need to understand the sort of risks and also the opportunities around climate change for the scheme.
There has been such a shift, hasn't there, in recent years with the way the city has dealt with things like this, because if you'd asked many organizations to do this 10 years ago, there would have been screaming and shouting from the rafters about, you know, the amount of bureaucracy involved, the fact that it's not so simple, et cetera, et cetera. But I mean, you'll know this better than I. It seems to me from my perspective that we've gone past that phase of people thinking ESG was something nice to care about, that climate in particular was something nice to care about, but it wasn't core, to actually a lot of businesses starting to put it right at the heart of their business, not just because they feel they need to and need to respond to wider political or social pressure, but because they think it's smart business. Is that where we are in pension funds, in pension schemes?
I think we're seeing a lot of these kind of moves being made. And if we think about it, you know, becoming net zero by 2050 is already the law here in the UK. You know, that's been set out by Parliament. And so now we're starting to see more and more net zero commitments that are coming from companies, from cities, from councils, but also from pension funds and from investors. So I think this is, it certainly is, as you said, a time when this is becoming, I guess, more mainstream. I don't think we are seeing people kicking and screaming, but I think what we are seeing is a real urgency in this change. So the government's made this commitment, and now we need to see the sort of policy change underneath that to deliver that zero carbon economy. And that's the sort of changes that we're starting to see today. So businesses and investors who are thinking in that way are going to set themselves up to sort of be able to transition that change, but also to you know, be successful and get good outcomes in that future net zero world.
And is that because, you know, we know that the DC market has kind of consolidated and is consolidating, you know, are employers, trustees and the like, are they looking for those schemes that have that stewardship, that have that ESG kind of, those ESG credentials?
Absolutely. I mean, this is something that we've been saying to our clients and to, you know, to the industry and to the sector as a whole. Now you have this real drive from the government to get DC schemes to consolidate, with some a consultation held last year setting out sort of requirements for the smaller schemes to think about whether they're giving good value or if they need to consolidate into something else. And of course, Master Trust is where those schemes are going to be looking to consolidate. So that's where we really need to see, you know, those people who are running Master Trust really getting ahead of the game. And those who've got the best sort of sustainability credentials, the best ESG credentials, those are going to be more attractive for some employers who are looking consolidate their scheme and do the best for their members. But you see those requirements that we're talking about that have come out this week, Master Trust needs to take those on board this year. So, you know, we are seeing that the government's definitely focused on that biggest end of the market where the consolidation is happening.
Yeah, no doubt. Attention in government elsewhere as well, moving from the DWP to number 11 and to Her Majesty's Treasury. The budget is inbound March the 3rd, still are obliged to do it by the, you know, by the end of the financial year, regardless of the fact that we are now confirmed to still be in lockdown. Then one assumes Rishi will do it from Parliament, but who knows? A few weeks ago, he was on this podcast and we didn't really touch on pensions. We were sort of focused on you know, the UK's extraordinary debt mountain and the future of the City of London. But there is a working theory that there will be some pensions elements. There always are in the budget. If you were a betting person, Amanda, where would you expect the Treasury to sort of start looking in that budget and start to move forward on pensions?
I think looking at the bigger picture, I think for pension investors, the really important sort of things coming in the next budget is more detail on the UK's Green Gilt and how, you know, what sort of rules will be around that and what that issuing will look like. So I think that's one of the things that pension investors will be looking like. On the broader side on pensions, I mean, there's the sort of ongoing debate around pensions tax relief and you know, whether that should be, you know, a single rate of tax relief. Who knows whether that sort of debate will come up again. I'm sure that the usual commentators will be raising the usual issues. But I think the more important thing for investors is looking at the sort of issuing the government's going to have in terms of their debt.
Mm. It's fascinating stuff. And presumably there will also be some changes, just thinking about regulation and various other things. The Pension Schemes Act will kick in 2021 this year. There'll be changes to the pensions dashboard, which I think most people regard as being quite positive. Do you want to give us a quick sort of summary of what those changes are and how it might change, you know, individuals as well as investors and their kind of responsibilities and their abilities, I suppose?
So at a high level, I mean, the idea around the pensions dashboard is that members, that pension holders can find out, you know, how much pension that they have, and they don't lose track of pension savings and you know, have multiple pots that they are no longer able to keep track of. But we've seen, I think, a reasonably measured approach to implementation of the dashboard with the expectation that this comes in now in 2023. So I think that's a reasonable way off in terms of the practical changes that people will start to see, but certainly is something positive that's on the horizon and should open up a whole load of new ways of people being able to communicate and engage with members if that's you know, if that's a way that people can find their pension savings.
Mm. It's a fascinating field, and I think there's no question that government has its eyes on it and trying to, you know, democratize it or actually use investors in particular and those master trusts as a way of driving their own policy agendas. So we will no doubt have to speak again, Amanda, as things move down the track. But for now, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. That's been great to speak to you.
And now to this week's special guest, Bill Browder. Now, all of us know some extraordinary life stories, but few, I think, can compete with Bill's. As a young man, he worked for investment banks and focused his efforts on Eastern Europe. And then at Solomon's, he broke into Russia, just as that country was going through privatizations the like of which the world had rarely ever seen. Bill's eye for an investment bargain worked a treat. He sat up on his own with seed funding from investment banker royalty in the form of Edmund Safra. As he built his Hermitage Fund, he slept on the floor of hotel rooms at Davos, took death-defying flights on battered Aeroflot jets to Murmansk, and grew his fund to extraordinary heights. In 10 years, it grew 3,000%. For much of the 2000s, he was Russia's largest foreign investor. Then things got weird. On a routine flight into Moscow in 2005, Browder was stopped and deported 24 hours later, without any food or water. He hasn't been back to Russia since. He discovered that he was the centre of an effort, reportedly led from the very top of the Russian state, to discredit him, his accomplices, and to, for all intents and purposes, destroy him. His offices were raided by Russian police. His friends' offices were raided by Russian police. His lawyers' offices were raided by Russian police, The document sees there eventually becoming the basis of a wild tax fraud. His lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, went public with Browder and his firm's evidence of a large, widespread tax fraud, sanctioned and authorised by the most senior Russian officials. In essence, the ownership of his fund, Hermitage, and its subsidiaries have been transferred to an individual with precisely nothing to do with them. Those documents seized in the raids provided the smoking gun. Through a series of court cases, this fake owner of Hermitage, who had used those documents to change the ownership structures on the records, had created a host of fake debt obligations on the firm. As a result, this vague fake Hermitage was to be the subject of a $230 million rebate from the Russian state. All of this happened without anybody at Hermitage having any real idea. But rather than opening an investigation, Russian police threw Magnitsky in jail. He died 11 months later, never having been charged. Russian authorities said he had died in prison of natural causes. But there is little question internationally that Magnitsky was in fact tortured and died from his injuries. There's a word for that: murder. Since then, Bill has been a driving force on the world stage in bringing pressure to bear on Vladimir Putin, his country's government, and indeed his acolytes abroad. So-called Magnitsky Acts, a version of which was first signed into the law in the US, and after much pressure and delay by the UK in 2018, allows assets to be frozen where there is sufficient evidence that they are tied to human rights violations, including state-sanctioned activities. Russia is the Magnitsky Act's main target, but it has expanded to be used against individuals from other countries known for human rights violations. He's been a recipient of myriad awards and acclaim, and in 2019, Browder received the Lantos Human Rights Prize from the Lantos Foundation for his work as the, quote, driving force behind the Magnitsky sanctions, the most consequential enforcement mechanism of the modern human rights movement, unquote. Right or wrong, not many fund managers end up with praise like that from human rights organisations. He's a thorn in Putin's side to this day, with the Russian leader scarcely able to mention his name. Hell, there were even suggestions of a swap deal with the US not so long ago. Browder is still wanted in Russia. But it is apparent that Vladimir Putin would sleep a little easier if Bill wasn't quite so vocal. And being vocal, here's Bill. Bill, pleasure to have you on.
Great to be back.
Yeah, thanks. Now, look, many of our listeners, CTM readers, will probably remember you from Red Notice, the book about your time in Russia, from privatization through your deportation, through the murder of Sergei Magnitsky, and then your quest for justice on his behalf, which, you know, we'll delve into some depth in a minute. But since the book came out, have you been more sort of more activist or more businessman, as you define it? Because, as I understand it, despite being the grandson of the leader of the Communist Party in America, self-defined capitalist, those animal spirits must still run through you a little.
Well, I would say that I spend almost all of my time on my human rights campaign. But having said that, I'm an investor in my heart, and I don't invest for anyone else, but I continue to invest my own money. And it's always like an interesting puzzle to figure out where the opportunities are to invest and what's going to go up and what's going to go down. And so I keep my eyes on the markets, and I maybe spend 20% of my time investing, but the vast majority of my time continues to be on this mission for justice that started with the murder of Sergei Magnitsky.
Yeah, which you talk about in the book in such a compelling way. You know, your book and your activism has been one of, if not probably the biggest, driving force, I think, behind the West almost waking up really to the threat of Russia. I still remember in the run-up to the Obama-Mitt Romney election in the States, when Mitt Romney said the greatest geopolitical threat to the US and indeed the world was the Russian government, and sort of extremely intelligent people in newspapers across the world thought the guy had gone mad, that this was some sort of Cold War mentality. And actually, since 2012 and since your book and since, you know, Vladimir Putin's activities have become more obviously aggressive, and shall we say, the West has woken up a little bit, and we'll talk about that in time. But I want to talk about that in Russia, a country you, of course, know so well. We now have another wave of protests in response to the arrest of Alexei Navalny, Putin's sort of most vocal Russian critic. Are things changing in Russia? Are these protests part of general move amongst the Russian population saying that actually enough is enough? Or is it just a small minority of people that are kind of having their moment, so to speak?
Well, definitely enough is enough in Russia, and it has been enough for a long time. But you ask an important question, which is, what is the tipping point? At which moment does it just finally spill out and everybody just says, I mean, truly enough is enough? And I think that we're kind of at that tipping point. We certainly saw the same thing happen in Belarus. Belarus is a country next to Russia. They have their own dictator who's been there even longer than Putin. And they had kind of tolerated his dictatorship up until about half a year ago, when he stacked the election dramatically in his favor when he really would have lost. And all sorts of apolitical people just said, truly enough is enough, and came out into the streets and have been protesting ever since in a way that really has challenged his legitimacy and probably will end his presidency. And Putin feels profoundly scared of the same thing happening in Russia. He's not scared of any individuals, but he's scared of the people rising up. And he saw that going on in Belarus. And he also saw that the economy is shrinking in Russia, that it's been a sort of economic depression, if you will, for many years, where nothing is really happening other than the state companies, and most people are living close to poverty. And Putin saw that what was going on in Belarus could easily be the spark that leads to Russia. And he was most afraid of Alexei Navalny, the person who is probably the most popular opposition person out there. And he was afraid that Alexei Navalny would lead the Russian uprising. And so he tried to kill him. He tried to kill him 5 months ago. So the Belarusian revolution started 6 months ago, and he tried to kill Navalny 5 months ago, and he failed. He failed because his assassins made some mistakes. And so Alexei Navalny eventually nursed himself back to health in a Berlin hospital, in a Berlin rehab clinic. And then Putin said, I don't want this guy back in Russia. I want to make him irrelevant here. And so he told the world and told Navalny that if he came back to Russia, he'd be arrested for parole violations. And he thought that, like any self-preserving individual, Navalny would heed that call and wouldn't come back and would sort of drift into political irrelevance. But he completely misjudged Alexei Navalny, who, unlike almost everybody else in the world, and certainly unlike any political leaders we've seen, he valued his principles and his patriotism more than his own safety and freedom. And he flew back to be arrested. And in a certain way, Putin became the hostage, not Navalny, once they arrested Navalny a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about being scared of the population of Russia. I saw, you know, obviously the pictures of the protests in places like Omsk and minus 30 Celsius, you know, the passions must be there. And Putin also, you know, his forces in various local police or whatever, cracking down on everything from, you know, snowmen protests to obviously not releasing Navalny. It does seem like there is a degree of paranoia there. But I guess, as so often is the case across the world when it comes to authoritarian regimes and governments like Vladimir Putin's, often it's about the economy and about people's life chances. And you mentioned there isn't a lot going on, but do you see the continued economic slowdown in Russia perhaps contributing to that tipping point? You know, there now is a focal point around Alexei Navalny in terms of a person that people can pin their hopes to. But is it going to be the economy that drives those apolitical people, you know, onto the streets more?
It's the economy certainly is a major contributor to that. And of course, every economy in the world is suffering dramatically because of the COVID-led economic catastrophe. But Putin has had a sclerotic economy for a long time. There's been no opportunity for small and medium-sized businesses to thrive. It's a totally corrupt country. And so, yes, people are, you know, when you're hungry, you get angry. And in Russia, people are hungry and they're angry. And all they need is to light the fuse. And Putin lit the fuse. You know, the thing he was most afraid of is a popular uprising. And by arresting Alexei Navalny, he got his popular uprising. And so then the real question now is, where does it go? does it grow or does it get extinguished? And I can't answer that question, nor could Putin, nor could Navalny, but there are several factors at work. One is, does the aggressive repression that's going on in Russia as we speak, does that cause people to go back into their kitchens to grumble, or does it cause people, more people, to go out into the streets? The second factor is, what has Navalny got up his sleeve? As most people know now, he published an unbelievable investigative YouTube video, 2 hours long, that shows that Putin is the owner of $1.5 billion palace on the Black Sea, with underground ice skating rinks and garages for 300 cars and 68 times the land mass of Monaco, and just, you know, $800 toilet cleaning brushes and just all sorts of crazy stuff. And the average person in Russia, so this has been viewed 90 million times, probably 85 million of those views came from Russia in a country of 144 million people. And so that has contributed a lot to, you know, people are saying, well, why should we put up with this guy, this corrupt guy who's building palaces for himself when we can barely eat? And surely Navalny's got other things up his sleeve. So the second big factor is, what does Navalny do in this whole situation? And then the third big factor is what do Western governments do? And this is one of those cases where he's become such a symbolic figure of defiance against dictatorship. The fact that they tried to kill him and he still stood up, and then they threatened to arrest him and he still stood up, that can't help but move anybody in the West who watches this, and particularly politicians and government officials. And so I would expect, things never happen as quickly as you want them to, but I would expect there to be serious Western sanctions against individuals in the Putin regime in response to this. And how serious those are and who they hit will also determine how this thing plays itself out. Because Putin, on one hand, will feel much more emboldened if the West does nothing than if they do things that hit him or people close to him.
It's fascinating you talk about that. Thinking closer to home here in London, I read this chat about, you know, a meeting that you have with David Cameron after he was prime minister, when he talked about why sanctions on corrupt Russian individuals through the Magnitsky Act, as it became in the UK, why David Cameron did not push ahead with those as quickly as you wanted him to. And it was about, I mean, you were there, you'll know the story better than myself, that it was the Foreign Office that pushed back. And I know you've often talked about being disappointed with the speed of the UK in particular's response to Russian corruption. So what did Cameron say? And then how do you feel about where we are now in 2021 and the UK's sort of current movement really on sanctions, and how the City of London is obviously engaged in that as well?
Well, the Cameron government had sort of blocked me at every stage as I was campaigning for the Magnitsky Act here in the UK. And they blocked me long after the US had passed their Magnitsky Act. And although you hear an American accent coming from me, I've been living here for 30 years. I'm a British citizen. And Sergei Magnitsky was working for a British company when he was falsely arrested, tortured, and murdered. And so, if anything, it was the UK's responsibility to have a Magnitsky Act. And it was interesting because I wrote my book called Red Notice in 2015, which describes my business life and then my life seeking justice for Sergei Magnitsky. And after Cameron left government and had a bit more time on his hands, he read my book. And I think he was very moved by my book. And he through a mutual friend, sent me an email asking me to lunch. And we went to lunch, and we literally, the moment we sat down, he said, "I want to apologize to you." He said, I after reading your book and understanding this, I see that I was wrong, that we should have done the Magnitsky Act, and I want to help you do the Magnitsky Act." And he actually weighed in during when Theresa May was prime minister, and his voice was an influential voice in making sure it happened. And he said that this is the this he can see the value of this tool. He can see how going after to freeze the assets of individual human rights violators is a very powerful tool. And having it a tool that, that countries can work together on applying is even more powerful. And so now where are we today? So he was being blocked by the Foreign Office. He was being, the civil servants in the Foreign Office were whispering him to him that this is a bad idea, you shouldn't do it. And you know, and it's interesting because the person who then, who had helped me push it through the government and get it through parliament and get it to be a law, at the time when he started was a backbench member of parliament named Dominic Raab. And he and I started working together as long ago as 2012. And I could tell he was a special person when I first met him. And he, and I was right, he his skills and talents elevated him from backbench to junior minister to senior minister and eventually to the foreign secretary. And as the foreign secretary, when those people were whispering to him that this shouldn't be done, he ignored their whispers because for him, this was, he understood exactly what was going on. So I would say that we're probably in better shape than we've ever been in here in the UK, as far as the Magnitsky Act is concerned in terms of implementing it. And I could easily imagine that the UK will, with Dominic Raab in place, will take a very robust stand towards Putin in the Navalny case. I don't think the UK is going to act alone. I think the UK will act in concert with other countries, as the UK should. But I think we're in a better place than we were a few years ago, for sure.
Yeah, and I think it will be interesting to see in particular what happens with financial sanctions on some of the people. You know, it's easy to say and easy to highlight certain individuals, certain quote-unquote oligarchs who would be subject to sanctions if the UK government went further. But what will be almost more interesting to see is how the UK government deals with the people around those individuals, the firms that move money around, et cetera, et cetera. And that'll be the real battlefield going forward. But you talked about not acting alone, and I think you're right there. Obviously, we've seen a bit of changing guard, obviously, in Washington. Joe Biden entering the White House probably set to have a quite different relationship with Vladimir Putin and Russia than certainly Donald Trump has. I doubt we'll be seeing them in Helsinki as Donald Trump did in 2018, meeting Putin there. But on the other hand, you've got the EU, which is seemingly unwilling to be as punchy as certainly the UK has been on Vladimir Putin's regime and on Russian oligarchs abroad, probably not as punchy as you expect the United States to be going forward. How does that work if you've got the UK acting as almost a junior partner with the US, if we make that leap of faith, but then you've got the EU and its relationships around energy, et cetera, unwilling to go as far? Does that fractured coalition allow Vladimir Putin and his acolytes to continue operating as normal?
It's a big problem. The EU is a real big problem. The way in which the EU makes decisions is through unanimity. All 27 countries have to make a foreign policy decision in agreement with one another. And what that has done, and that's the rules of foreign policy in the EU. And what that's done is it allows any little country to veto a major foreign policy decision. And so Putin has his Trojan horses in the EU. And one of those Trojan horses is his friend, Viktor Orban, who's the prime minister of Hungary. And Orban has made no secret of the fact that he admires, respects, and wants to be close to Putin. And Viktor Orban was one of the people who blocked the Magnitsky Act for many years from being an EU piece of legislation. And it was only through some interesting other ways of applying pressure to Orban that we were able to get it through the EU. But getting any punchy sanctions lists out of the EU are going to be equally hard to do because of this unanimity veto right that allows little countries like Hungary to mess about the whole system. And so I have very strong doubts about whether the EU will be a player in these conversations. Now, that doesn't mean that the UK, the US, and Canada and hopefully soon to be Australia can't weigh in and make a point. And if the US does it with the UK, I think that does have a very significant impact on the cronies, the billionaire cronies around Putin, because they're all here in London keeping their money here. We have a disproportionate voice in all these conversations, because if we freeze their assets, we've taken away one of their most coveted privileges, coming here, having houses here, having their kids go to school here. And I wouldn't underestimate how important that is.
Certainly, I think you're right. And it'll be interesting to watch the UK government's response over the next couple of years as it begins, you know, frankly, a more independent foreign policy, for better or for worse, after leaving the European Union. Ask sort of one last question really about the last few years and maybe the next few years, Bill, is the world has woken up to Russia. So in one sense, your campaign has been effective in building a coalition of countries, of commentators, of newspapers, of just impartial watchers realizing that something is very amiss in Moscow. What's next in terms of justice for Sergei Magnitsky and his family, and for your activism, I suppose?
Well, what's next is we need to get other countries signed up. We're currently working on Australia right now, and I think we're close to getting the Australian Magnitsky Act in place. Just yesterday, there was a new cross-party parliamentary group formed in the Japanese Diet, their parliament, to do a Japanese Magnitsky Act. New Zealand is on deck, South Africa is on deck. And so my hope is to have as many countries as possible have Magnitsky Acts. And then my next hope is to get the countries that do have the Magnitsky Act to implement it robustly, not just in the case of Russia, in the case of China as well. The Chinese, and I should say the Magnitsky Act applies globally to all bad guys. The Chinese are running concentration camps. It's intolerable. It's an intolerable thing to know that there's, for the Uyghur people, they're being rounded up into concentration camps. We cannot allow this to go unnoticed and unpunished. And then all over the world, there are terrible atrocities, probably increasing at the moment, because every dictator thinks that the eyes of the world are off of them because of COVID. And so there's a lot of work to be done to having this tool become commonly used, so that every bad guy knows that if they do something terrible, they will be sanctioned. Their assets will be frozen and their visas will be canceled.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I think, you know, many people in the city will certainly wish you luck on that quest. One last question, if I can nick the time, is, you know, in a world in which either Putin comes back to the international table and becomes a more, you know, normal, quote-unquote, leader, or the regime changes, leadership changes, and you were able to go back and go to Moscow and walk around, would you?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I have great love for Russia and for the Russian people generally. I don't have any love for the Putin regime or the criminals that work for him in his criminal enterprise, but it's a lovely country, and the people there are some of the best people I've ever met. My wife is Russian. Some of my staff that have been with me for 20 years are Russian, and I really feel deprived that I've been sort of cut off from a country which where I have also deep family roots, and I would like to be able to go there and not fear of death and arrest.
Yeah, well, you can understand that. Well, let's hope that is sooner rather than later, Bill. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll speak again.
Thank you.
Fascinating stuff. Our thanks to Bill for joining us, as well as Amanda and James. That'll be all from us on The City View in partnership with CMC Markets for now. We'll see you next week. That was the City View podcast in partnership with CMC Markets. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. And in the meantime, all the news, analysis, and opinion you need will be on cityam.com.
CMC Markets is a pioneering CFD and spread betting provider. With more than 30 years of experience, CMC Markets provides traders with the tools they need to trade confidently.
76% of retail investor accounts lose money.